This is the third memoir of my childhood. It completes that that kind of trilogy. My first was Pulling Down the Barn, which was about the family stories. The second one is called House of Fields, and that's the rural education. But I felt I had something more to say about that time period in the 60s, you know, a really, really important time. And so I was thinking a lot about that and realized that I had been in 4-H that entire time. From 1959 to 1969, I was in 4-H. And that became the controlling metaphor and sort of device of the lessons and the changes. And so what happens is that in this memoir, I'm remembering how my mother tried so hard to keep me in line and keep developing a sort of proper public persona through the 4-H lessons. But the truth of the matter is the 60s were happening. And while I wasn't anywhere near the forefront, there was that cultural spill that happened, I think, to many of us growing up in that time. And honest to Pete, that's the tension between, you know, that those really all-American wholesome lessons that were coming to me through the 4-H Club, but then the cultural spill that I was drawn to, the larger world that I was being introduced to, ironically, through 4-H, and what I was learning. So it's the, you know, 4-H, but it's also learning about the things of the time. And for me, in some ways, that was learning about love and sex, too.
Well, as anybody in that age, teens. And what part of Michigan are we setting this book?
This book is set in my home county, Oceana County, which is on the west coast, the sort of not the thumb side, the opposite side.
See, we can't do this on radio where you hold up that
no,
hand for Michigan.
So the book is set in Oceana County, which is on the opposite side of the thumb, and it's near, my little village was called Crystal Valley, which barely exists anymore. So the high school town, which is the town I refer to most of the time, is called Hart.
And what kind of population does Hart have? How big of a, or small?
It's not a large town. I think it's maybe between 5,000 and 7,000. It may have been a little bit larger at that time. But it was a small town. It was considered a small town, and it had all the small town mentalities that we appreciate or sometimes don't appreciate so much.
Right, until you come back later.
Right.
Is it fair to say it's a farming town?
Well, it's deeply influenced by agriculture. You're right about that. It's one of the National Asparagus Festival often happens in Hart. It's surrounded by asparagus and orchards and vegetable farming. So, yes, I would say that's a very, very astute analysis of the whole community.
And give us a little bit of background, Anne-Marie. You mentioned you have other books, and this is part of a trilogy. Are you also a poet and essayist?
Well, I am. And a memoir is a kind of subcategory of essay, I think, especially the way I'm shaping it, because I work from moment to moment. This is not a memoir that goes and then. It's episodic, but each episode you could probably read alone and enjoy it as it is. So I write essays, but I also write poetry. I have a book called Uncoated Woman from Milkweed Editions, and that one is a narrative series of poems based on the International Code of Signals. I don't know if you've ever seen those flags that they fly on the beautiful ships, you know, those pennants. Well, each one of those stands for a letter, and each one of those combinations of those flags are codes. And so I use those codes as titles to tell the story of a young woman, a troubled young woman coming north. So it's a narrative series of poems. And I like it. I like it very much, working in those ways. And then I'm also a playwright. So I periodically find that I have to tell a story that's all in spoken word, and that's fun too.
And is there a particular way you choose which medium you're going to use, which style, or does it choose itself?
You know, that's a really good question. That used to be a problem for me. Now it's intuitive. It used to be like I'd start a poem and I'd go, oh, this is really an essay. Or I'd start an essay and I'd realize there was not much there, but then I'd realize, oh, but if it's a poem, then it has something to say. Or, you know, any of those kinds of switching around. And now I kind of know when an idea presents itself, it feels more, and that's probably practice, that you come to know what the idea is, what genre, what shape the idea wants to take.
Yeah. And I've always wondered, because I write as well, and I've played with memoirs and that kind of a thing. And what I always come up against is that worry that family and friends are going to disown me. But you know, your reader knows when you're holding back too. So
right.
how do you face that as a writer of memoirs?
Well, my motives for writing have to be, I don't want to sound self-aggrandizing here, but they have to be loving. You know, you can't ever write for sensation or to make yourself a victim or to, you know, be a martyr to somebody else. Or, you know, it has to be a story that shows human motives. And I like to look at moments that are transformative in a positive way or that lead to a complexity that's a human understanding that we have to have in order to grow in some way or to understand the world.
Are your parents still alive?
My mother is still alive, and I have given and always give my family copies of the manuscript in draft before it goes to press. And give them the chance to read it and to say something if they want to say. And it's interesting, they have come to understand, we've had interesting conversations about this, that memory is not always the same as fact. And their memory is not the same as mine in every case. It's not that they don't have the memory. It's that the memory will have different emotional values. For example, in my first book, Pulling Down the Barn, there's a chapter called Violence, in which my brothers have a terrible fight, and my perception, because I've been left in charge of them, is that one of my brothers is trying to kill the other brother.
Right.
And it's a pretty, for me, it just carried incredible emotional weight, because I had been left in charge, and I thought this was a violation and a violence, and it really terrified me. For them, you know,
it
when
was
I,
just great
I,
fun.
I remember this. Yeah, oh, this was just business as usual. So,
yeah.
So the memory that we have, they've come to understand, and we've all come to agree that it's a malleable thing, that it's not quite the same as history. And they understand that I am trying to tell a truth about my life that I hope will resonate with my readers. And they've been very, very lovely about that. In this book, because there were so many more public figures, so in this book, there were many more friends who and people who I mentioned, and I made a decision to change all their names.
That's probably wise, yeah.
And my family names, because for continuity with the other books, I left my family names the same. But for the, you know, all the people from 4-H that I mentioned, most everybody's name is changed. I think there's one teacher's name that slipped through that I just forgot to do it. But I don't say anything negative, so it's okay.
And what about putting yourself in that spotlight? It's you really have to be brave to get out there. And I read and enjoyed the book, and it felt very authentic to me. You know, resist that temptation to make a hero out of yourself, and I think you did that. But how was that for you? Is that difficult? Do you have to fight that as you write to, okay, I'm going to expose this weakness or this moment that I'm not particularly proud of?
You know, I feel like that, I'm thinking carefully about this, but I think it's a vulnerability that it creates a kinship with my reader.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't hesitate because I don't feel heroic. I feel clumsy, and that is interesting and to me revealing to go and look at that rather than trying to cover that up or make that into something else, to go and just authentically look at the discomfort there and say, oh, this is what it's like, and kind of base it on the assumption that I share with readers something like that will find a kinship or a little almost spiritual connection, because we're all in some way so vulnerable and we all make mistakes, and it's hard to own up to it because we live in a world where we have to present such a confident persona.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of what I try to do to help readers enter that world. Does that make sense?
It does. It absolutely does. And you really get through that teen angst and always feeling, that am I doing the right thing? And am I doing it the way everybody else is doing it? And, mm-hmm. and all of that.
And how do I make friends? And I don't make friends. And then I make I have the wrong boyfriend.
Common experiences. And of course, from the title, of course, you can tell that, but the book focuses keenly on 4-H. Do you work still today with 4-H?
You know, 4-H influences my life so deeply, but I have not worked in 4-H at all until just recently because of the book. Mm-hmm. I've reconnected with some of the 4-H people. I've become aware of the 4-H Foundation. And, it's a sort of renewing time for me to go back and look at the club itself and the program and what it's doing now. It's been really fascinating to rediscover it. I did not, when I left 4-H, I earned that 10-year pin, and I wanted to let go of the club itself because I was moving into a whole new world. I was going to college and of course, I carried with me, though, the lessons that I learned, not so much from the club itself, but from learning to sew. Those are the lessons that I have lived all these many, many years. Not from sewing itself, but more indirectly from the way you think about sewing. The idea of living in an economy where you looked, instead of looking at the whole bolt of fabric, you looked at the remnants, or you learned to put things together that would not normally be together. There was a creativity in sewing under those constraints, and we sewed because we didn't have a lot of money then. Clothes were not cheap, and or at least not in my world. So the whole idea of using a pattern and saving money and figuring out how to be to put things together in new ways, using what you had over and over again. All of those values came from the 4-H Club, and those were values I carried over and over from the lessons my mom gave me. So I think 4-H is with me in a big way, even though I haven't had a strong association with the club.
Did you feel very sharply the differences between growing up in a farming family in the country and the kids who grew up in town?
I did, and I think many of us did. And I mentioned this somewhere in the book, that the kids who lived in town had the advantage of knowing each other. Many of them grew up together in the same schools, and were already familiar, and they had friendships and with each other, and went back and forth, and they knew where they lived. Well, not only were the country kids not in those same schools, but we didn't even really know each other lots of times, because we were in these far-flung schools. So even though I suspect that if you talk to people who grew up in towns like that, they were not so keenly aware of the differences, I think the country kids felt it, even if... Maybe those divisions were not as true, not in actuality as great as we perceived. But I think that we perceive them as maybe bigger than what they were. So that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
And sometimes, as life will do, your world goes beyond where you live, and you take on some bigger events in the world around you, the Cuban Missile Crisis, mm-hmm. About Kennedy, civil rights mm-hmm. with Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
That was part of what I was thinking about as this book evolved, was I wanted to do something that was not so insular. You know, those first two books are, you know, they're beautifully focused on this interior world or the world of the small schools. And in this book, I wanted to show and incorporate that larger historical context and really work with what we were feeling at the time. I mean, everybody in my generation remembers where they were when the news came that John Kennedy had been assassinated. And many of us remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. Many of us have strong and frightening memories about the Detroit riots, especially here in Michigan. And so I wanted to incorporate that to widen the envelope of the book, to let in different kinds of light, and some of those would be the historical light. And I do that sometimes through juxtaposing small, intimate moments, like in the chapter about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm learning to create an invisible hem, and that was the 4-H lesson that coordinates with that year, and that is happening at the same time that, of course, my father, who was a World War II vet and deeply concerned about the state of the world, was virtually making a bunker in our basement. So
that was typical for the time, too, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So those juxtapositions are a device that I use to try and widen the impact of that particular book.
And what about the rise of feminism? Because I think a lot of that mm-hmm. began around that time as well.
I couldn't agree more. The first lesson, and this is when I speak to libraries and bookstores and places, groups, I show them, I have actually still have it because my mother saved it, the first lesson of the sewing program, which was to make a dish towel.
Yeah.
And so I show people this actual dish towel that I made. And the second lesson,
I still have it. Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that fun? My mom, she saved it. But then the second lesson is an apron. Those were the lessons in 1959 and 1960. So that tells you where we are. By the end of that decade, I'm making mini dresses and bell bottoms and all kinds of clothing that would have been considered revolutionary in the earlier years. So the actual sewing lessons track the sort of change in attitude from compliance to, if not defiance, at least breaking away.
And you did have this wonderful spirit of rebellion that just kept coming through and driving your mom a bit nuts.
Oh, I know it. I feel so sad for her now. She went through a lot.
And those first loves and first kisses, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. a big part of your story.
It is. I tried to remember that naivete and that insecurity and then that first burst of longing and experimentation and, yeah.
So do you still sew, Anne-Marie?
You know, I didn't sew for years because it felt like the way I thought was kind of a way of sewing. But I have purchased a sewing machine. And I am starting to move back to it. And it's so surprising to me. It's coming back, you know, that way of thinking, that explicit rather than implicit way of thinking is actually returning. So it's slowly, you know, time is an issue, but it's slowly coming back. And I'm kind of thrilled about it.
Life tends to be that way. We go full circle. The things we might have resisted bring us comfort later on.
Yeah.
So are you doing some kind of author tours, book tours?
I am. I've been speaking. I at many bookstores, many libraries, as they call, and going out to do programs. And the programs are focused on the book, of course, but it's also just introducing a little bit of the history of 4-H as it was then, a little bit of it as it is now, and then also trying to show people some of the old photographs that would really communicate the complexity of the time and the love of the time.
I would have loved to have seen more photographs in that book. That's my only complaint.
Oh, I understand. I don't know if you know, but the cover is the cover of, it's actually me.
Yes, that I figured out.
And it's the prom dress that I made for my sophomore prom.
It's that yellow one, isn't it, that you changed around, tore the sleeves off and gave it a little more of a neckline.
Right. Exactly.
Any plans at all to come down to Southwest Michigan? You're in Traverse City
right
now, right?
I just need to be invited.
Oh, I'll get the word out for you.
Yeah, if there's a way that they can, you know, support my trip down there, I would be happy to come.
Okay, and I'd like to finish up if you have maybe a couple of paragraphs so we can get a bit of flavor of how you write.
I do have, if I might read a couple of paragraphs about that yellow dress. And this is the eve of my first prom, and we are just arriving, or just leaving for the prom. Finally, into the car and the ride to the castle. We would not be townies and country kids, but prom-goers. Promenade. Earl and I would parade through that spring dusk into the gym and join a gang of kids in ties and tight shoes. It was a rough unity. We would drink sweet punch and marvel at the un-gymming of the gym to this year's theme, Brigadoon. And we would dance, shaking our bodies to sweat and breathlessness. The band would turn up the volume and loosen the very air. We felt wild. We were tamed. If we had listened, we would have heard not the dirty vibrations of oversized speakers, but the underpinnings of that culture shaking loose. Outside of that gym, beyond the town and the lakes, civil rights workers demonstrated, a war escalated, and protesters marched against that war on both East and West coasts. But we were of the Midwest, or rather, not quite the Midwest, but the Great Lakes, and not even the great cities of those Great Lakes, but a small town set inland of those inland seas. In that moment, what we heard was not the march of change, but the beat of Aretha Franklin and Jimi Hendrix blaring out the open doors and over our newly plowed fields. We would be blind for a long time, but music was the first way we blew our minds. If someone could sing it, then eventually someone would latch onto the lyrics and someone brighter than me would spread the word about every state of being from heartbreak to revolution. But not at prom. At prom, we leaped and let that beat pierce our small souls. Blessed were we who did not know much, held in the castle, surrounded by our own narrow cornfield.